Considering that rather long passage that I read a moment ago, Mark chapter 10, verses 32 to 52. And before I get into any of my points this evening, I just want to begin with a few comments about the passage before us. Our passage begins in verse 32 with quite a striking image, isn't it? Jesus marching down the road ahead of his disciples. He's sort of leading the way with his followers trailing behind. That's often the kind of impression we get when we read the Gospels, isn't it? For many, there was something irresistible about Jesus. He just had to be followed. You remember how back in chapter 1 of this Gospel, Jesus had called out to those fishermen, Simon and Andrew and James and John, "Follow me." And immediately they drop their nets and they follow him and they become like fish caught in Jesus' net. And from that day onwards, they can't get themselves unhooked. They're following him. And that is all the more remarkable considering how these disciples are now feeling in verse 32. Look there again in verse 32. We're told that those who followed were afraid. They were afraid. Why ever were they afraid? Well, surely because they knew where Jesus was leading them to. They were going up to Jerusalem, we're told in verse 32. And twice already in this gospel, Jesus has told his disciples about certain events which more than likely will take place once they get there. Chapter 8, verse 31, we read these words. "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly," we're told. Then chapter 9, verse 31, "For he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, 'The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise.'" And now in chapter 10, verse 33, on a third occasion, he tells them again. Only this time we get even more information. He clarifies the location. "See, we are going to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death." He then brings in another party, and they will deliver him over to the Gentiles, he says. And then he gives the graphic details of what will happen to him. "And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise." So these disciples then, they are hooked, they are compelled to follow their leader Jesus, but they do so fearfully and with a sense of trepidation about what going up to Jerusalem will involve. Firstly for their teacher, and then by extension for themselves. But you see, now a puzzle arises. How is it then that only one moment after Jesus speaks these fearful words, we find these disciples once again preoccupied with worldly greatness? In verse 35, we see James and John this time asking Jesus for their own thrones. I mean, given their apparent fear, their knowledge of what's going to happen when they get to Jerusalem, how is it that now of all times they're making this ridiculous self-centered request for greatness and for glory? Why now? Well, it's been something of a bit of a recurring pattern, hasn't it? After Jesus' first prediction in chapter 8, instantly Peter responds by proudly rebuking Jesus. After the second prediction in chapter 9, the disciples instantly are found arguing with themselves about who is the greatest. And now, in chapter 10, these disciples approach Jesus asking for thrones. You see, it's not that they hadn't heard what Jesus was telling them. I mean, why else would Peter have rebuked Jesus in the first place? Why else would they be afraid on the road to Jerusalem? No, we're told that Jesus had taught them plainly about this. They'd heard him all right. They couldn't have missed it even if they tried. No, the reason why we have these outbursts, I think, in pride is surely that there remains part of these disciples, there remains part of them which is strongly resisting Jesus' warnings. Something in them is willfully closing their eyes to these Jerusalem predictions. Part of them wants to remain blind to what Jesus is saying will happen in Jerusalem because it's just too costly to their sense of self-worth, to their egos, to their high hopes of political success. And I would even say then that the closer they get to Jerusalem, the more pronounced that inner resistance becomes. The reality of Jesus' words are hard to resist. Jerusalem is looming closer and closer. Their fears are becoming worse and worse. And so part of them has to fight back all the more strongly. Their attempt to suppress that fear with the possibilities of greatness and glory becomes all the more pronounced. And perhaps one of the ways in which they do this is by focusing in their minds only on the positive features of Jesus' teaching. I mean, Jesus, on those three occasions, had described himself as the Son of Man. The Son of Man, that glorious figure in the Old Testament, who was a king, one who would inherit the nations. That's a much more appealing idea to these disciples right now. That's the bit they want to focus on in their own minds. Perhaps that's what they're thinking. And so at times like this then, they'll seize upon anything to distract themselves, to comfort their own egos, to try to deter and to forget about what is going to happen once they arrive in Jerusalem. And in all of this then, we could say that in a certain way, the rich young ruler, the rich man in the previous passage, is kind of re-entering the scene in Mark chapter 10, in this passage of Mark chapter 10. It's as if his ghost is now inhabiting James and John. It's interesting, isn't it, that just like that rich man who we've just been considering last week, James and John also describe Jesus, address Jesus like that rich man did. They both call him teacher. That's what they call him, a term of respect, but one which sort of conveys some remoteness, some distance. It's a little bit cold. And then just like that rich man, James and John also approach Jesus wanting to inherit something. They want some kind of trophy, some kind of additional thing to add into their lives, to supplement their lives, to put the cherry on top of their possessions. Now, of course, unlike the rich man, James and John are at least following Jesus, something the rich man couldn't bring himself to do. But even still, for both James and John, and for the rich man of the previous passage, the desire for greatness, the desire for glory, that characterizes their relationship with Jesus right now. It's getting in the way. It's interrupting things. And I guess I should just pause at this point and say that by coming to the end of chapter 2, we have reached the end of a distinct section of Mark's gospel. You see, from chapter 8, this gospel has focused on the training, the teaching of the disciples as they're on the road to Jerusalem. And the focus of that training on the road to Jerusalem has been the theme of servanthood. We've seen that time and time again over recent weeks. And so it's easy, isn't it, once we get to this part of chapter 10, to think to ourselves, well, how many times? I mean, how many times have we seen Jesus teach these disciples about embracing unimpressive Christian life, embracing humility, embracing servanthood and self-sacrifice, becoming like children, the cost of following him? How many times has Jesus reiterated these things, and yet how many times have we seen these disciples failing to learn, acting again and again and again with total selfishness and completely missing the point of Jesus' teachings? Constantly aspiring for greatness and glory when they should be humbling themselves before him. How many times? But then, if we're honest, isn't it also the case that we see something of ourselves in James and John and their recurring problems? We too find ourselves falling back into the same pride and selfishness and desire for personal greatness again and again, do we not? we too find ourselves in need of Jesus' correction again and again. Yes, on one level, it's preposterous to see these disciples acting like this, but at the same time, it's also a very realistic picture, isn't it? We look at this passage and part of us says, that's me. I'm the slow learner. I'm the one committing the same self-centered sins with predictable frequency again and again. And so then, conscious that we'll soon be leaving this portion of Mark's Gospel, I think it's just appropriate for us to challenge ourselves one more time on this whole issue of personal greatness and worldly glory. And to once again address this question, how do we deal with this recurring sin in our lives as Christians? How does this passage in particular once again teach us as slow learning, prideful, self-centered disciples? And one answer I could give to that question, a simple answer I could give to that question, would simply be to say to you, reject greatness. Reject any promise of glory. Do not desire those things. Shun them. And of course, taken in one sense, that answer would be quite right. But that's not the answer I want to give you today, because that's not the answer I think we find in this passage. No, the answer I want to give you this evening is actually this. Embrace greatness. Embrace glory. Do desire those things. Only make sure you are looking for them in the right place. That is to say, this passage doesn't condemn greatness and glory per se. Rather, it gives us a different perspective on greatness and glory. It redefines those things. It tells us what true greatness and true glory look like. And it tells us, in a word, that true greatness and true glory are found in service. Christian service, servant-heartedness, is great and is glorious. And that's really the message that I want to bring home to you in the remainder of our time this evening by peering into this passage. Christian service is great and is glorious, and I'm going to attempt to bring that message home to you under three headings. Firstly, avoid the shallow glory of the Gentiles. Avoid the shallow glory of the Gentiles. It's interesting that it's James and John who approach Jesus on this occasion, isn't it? James and John and Peter were the inner three, the three people who made up Jesus' inner circle. But obviously you can't have three thrones around Jesus' throne in the throne room. At most, there can only be two thrones sitting either side of Jesus. And so it seems then that both of these brothers have waited for an opportunity when Peter is absent and then have made their request. It's a deliberate attempt on the part of James and John to advance their status over the other disciples. And it's no surprise then that when the other disciples do find out about this in verse 41, they are very angry at James and John. They're indignant, we're told. Peter, you can imagine, would have been livid. But you see, the thing is that the indignation of these disciples is really showing themselves to be no better than James and John. Their anger, it seems, stemmed from the same sense of ambition that drove James and John to make their request in the first place. Because they're indignant, they're angry, because they don't want those two little grubby brothers to be sitting on the thrones. No, they want to sit on those thrones themselves. And that's why I think when Jesus calls the disciples to him, he now rebukes all of them in verse 42. And what does he say? How does he rebuke them? Well, he says to them, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise it over them, but it shall not be so among you. So I'm saying all of them, I think, felt the sting of those words, and those words really would have stung them. I mean, let's face it, Jesus is implying that these disciples are taking their cues from the Gentiles, of all people. He's saying that in desiring power over each other, they are acting upon the same impulses that direct the affairs of the Gentiles. And you see, Jews had thought of themselves as totally separate from the Gentiles. That was part of their self-identity. They had been called to higher things than the Gentiles. They were an elect nation. That was a source of national pride for them. And yet, at the heart, Jesus is saying they were now acting no differently. In other words, they were becoming their own worst nightmare. That pride of theirs, that was Gentile behavior. That was degeneration. That was ignorance. That was animal instinct on the part of these disciples. But then there's more. The thing which makes Jesus' remark here particularly pointed is that Jesus has only just mentioned the Gentiles back in verse 33. He said there that the Son of Man will be delivered over to the Gentiles. And I think the disciples then couldn't have missed the point. Those ugly, selfish Gentile desires which were swelling up in them, those very desires, Jesus is saying, would very soon lead to a terrible atrocity. They would lead to the death of their teacher, Jesus himself. Jesus is now turning to these disciples and he's saying, those indignant mouths of yours, they're Gentile mouths. They're the same kinds of mouths which will soon be showering me in mockery and spit. Gentiles will soon be flogging me, will soon be killing me, and you're acting no differently to them. And really then, Jesus' point is, what kind of glory then do you get in behaving like that? To be a ruler of the Gentiles, to lord it over others, is that what you want? You think that is glorious? You think that is great? That's not great. That's not glorious. It's interesting, isn't it, that Jesus calls them in verse 42, those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles. Considered rulers. And that's, I think, closer to the heart of the point I'm making here. Gentile greatness and glory, at the end of the day, is little more than a considered glory. It's a perceived glory. They might consider themselves as great ones. Others might consider them to be great ones. But at the end of the day, it's a shallow glory. It consists in the considerations of a few men 1 minute, which then passes the next minute. These are not really great ones. Gentile greatness, Gentile glory is only considered greatness, considered glory. It's fake glory. It's shallow glory. And so my first point to you this evening is simply to tell yourself of this when you find yourself daydreaming like these disciples were, thinking about those in high positions in our society, those who are part of celebrity culture, those who are high up in politics, and you find yourself daydreaming about how you might try to find a way to get access to that class of people. And then you think about what it might be like to have that kind of fame and prominence. When you find yourself doing that, remind yourself, I am acting like an unenlightened Gentile, and you're a Christian. You don't take your cues from pride and selfishness and ambition and rivalry. That's not how you act anymore. That's not part of you. Do not act like that. That is to step backwards into the way of the Gentiles. And then remember, that glory that you're looking upon, that the people in those high positions possess, that's a shallow glory. That's a glory that consists in the considerations of a few people and nothing more. If you desire power and fame in that sort of way, if that's where you seek your glory, you need to ask yourselves, at the end of the day, what is it that I'm seeking? I'm seeking for the passing respect, the passing submission, the passing consideration of a few jealous admirers who are there 1 minute and gone the next. That's not real glory. That's not worth it. No, avoid that. It's shallow. It's not worth the effort. Avoid the shallow glory of the Gentiles. So that's my first point this evening. My second is this. Aspire for the surviving glory of Bartimaeus. Aspire for the surviving glory of Bartimaeus. Bartimaeus, of course, introduces himself to our passage in verse 46. And I don't think it's accidental that we bump into Bartimaeus at this point of Mark's gospel. I think Bartimaeus appears in this gospel at precisely the point when he was meant to. Let me tell you why I think this. Notice a few things about Bartimaeus. Notice, for one thing, how he is deliberately contrasted with James and John. Mark brings this out by having Jesus ask them exactly the same question in the same wording. He asks it to James and John in verse 36 and to Bartimaeus in verse 51. And the question is, what do you want me to do for you? Mark is sort of setting us up to see how these two people will answer the same question differently. And their answers do starkly contrast one another. James and John ask for thrones. You could even say that they're asking for blindness, that they're wanting to remain blind to what Jesus is saying will happen to him in Jerusalem. Bartimaeus, on the other hand, doesn't have those high aspirations. He is asking simply for the recovery of his sight. And so there's an intentional contrast between these two parties. But then, even more strikingly, I think there's an intentional contrast between Bartimaeus and the rich man that we encountered last week. Notice the differences. On the one hand, that man was rich. Bartimaeus, we find in verse 46, is a beggar. That man was influential and successful. Bartimaeus is sitting by the roadside. He's an outcast. That man was the epitome of self-sufficiency. Bartimaeus is the epitome of dependency. Have mercy on me, he cries out in verse 48. We can't imagine the rich man saying that. And then ultimately, while this rich man's great possessions prevent him from following Jesus, and Jesus does say to him, come follow me, and he can't bring himself to do that, Bartimaeus, because of his poverty, is in a different situation altogether. If anything hinders Bartimaeus, it's only that cloak which he throws off himself in verse 50 happily, and then does precisely what the rich man couldn't do. He follows Jesus on the way in verse 52. So again, I think the two parties are intentionally contrasted. You see, what Bartimaeus is doing for us in this passage is he's providing us with the model disciple. He is the counterexample to the rich man. He follows Jesus whatever the cost. And my point is that actually, for all of his poverty then, Bartimaeus enjoys something which the rich man doesn't enjoy. At the end of this chapter, Bartimaeus goes home in a more desirable condition, or follows Jesus in a more desirable condition than the rich man. I mean, think about the rich man. He goes home far richer than Bartimaeus. He goes home far more powerful and far more influential than Bartimaeus. But he doesn't go away happier. No, for all of that, we read in verse 22, being disheartened by the saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. That sentence almost sounds like a contradiction in terms, doesn't it? Sorrowful because he had great possessions. And yet that was the truth of it. He goes away sorrowful. But what about Bartimaeus? Well, in one sense, he has nothing. And by the end of the passage, he doesn't even have his own garment. And yet, he has everything. He has his eyesight. He has Jesus. Who could care for more than that? The idea of exchanging Jesus for anything else, or his eyesight for anything else, is ridiculous. He leaves this passage happier and more fulfilled than the rich man does. He follows Jesus with a spring in his step and a smile on his face. And in this sense, then, Bartimaeus fulfills the teaching of Jesus. Jesus says to his disciples in verses 43 and 44, whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. And Jesus had basically said the same thing time and time again over the last couple of chapters. In chapter 8, 34, he said, if anyone would follow me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake in the Gospels will save it. He had said in chapter 9, 35, if anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. And he'd said in chapter 10, 31, but many who are first will be last, and the last first. And on the surface, that seems like a very unrealistic rule, doesn't it? It seems completely unbelievable that the last would be first. And yet here we are at the end of chapter 10, seeing this rule now perfectly exemplified. On the one hand, we have the rich man, who is first in one sense, but last in another. He has one form of glory, but lacks another form of glory. And then we have Bartimaeus. He's last in one sense. He's blindly begging for mercy at the feet of Jesus, and yet he is first in another. Bartimaeus enjoys a kind of greatness and a kind of glory that the rich man never could enjoy. True greatness, better greatness, real greatness. And my heading for this point was surviving greatness. I described the surviving greatness of Bartimaeus. Why did I say that? Well, I described the Gentile glory. Surviving glory. I described the Gentile glory as shallow glory because I said it exists in the considerations of people 1 minute and is gone the next minute. And I suppose it's ironic that the rich man, for all his renown that he would have had, today we only know him as a rich man. Who exactly is this rich man? Nobody knows. And no matter how much research a modern historian wanted to put into finding out who this rich man was, he could never really know. We do not know who this man was. I was saying in the Bible, I was saying on Wednesday night, how in the Bible, names have prominence in the scriptures, and how a name means someone's reputation often. The Tower of Babel builders wanted a name for themselves. They wanted reputation. They wanted renown and glory and greatness. The endurance of someone's name represents that. We do not have a name for this rich man. He is just a rich man. He leaves the passage nameless. But it's interesting, isn't it, that Bartimaeus, on the other hand, doesn't leave the passage nameless. Mark chooses to preserve his name. In fact, Bartimaeus is the only person Jesus heals in this gospel who is given a name. And I take that as a little indication that Mark is pleased to give poor Bartimaeus a more lasting honour than the rich man. That's why I called it a surviving glory then. He enjoys a glory and honour which outlives that of the rich man. And I think Mark is indicating something by doing that. He's reminding us that when this world is past, and when all the kingdoms of the world are ashes, and when the names of our modern celebrities and politicians are just idle curiosities at best, those who follow Jesus, who find themselves last of all in this world, and persecuted and obscure and despised, those people will, in that new world, enjoy a surviving glory, a glory that never fades. The glory of those others would fade, but not the glories of God's poor people. Their names will go on with them into the new world for all eternity. And so I say to you this evening, aspire to be like Bartimaeus. Aspire for his surviving glory. Don't hunger after the temporary glory of the Gentiles. No, want something which lasts. Come away richer than the rich man does. Be like Bartimaeus. We're richer than any celebrity, any musician, any sports personality, any TV presenter or actor or whoever it might be. There's glory in this man Bartimaeus through his servanthood, through his following of Jesus. By being last in this world, he becomes first in the next. So, my 2 points so far. Avoid the shallow glory of the Gentiles. Aspire for the surviving glory of Bartimaeus. And then thirdly and finally, adore the saving glory of the Son of Man. Adore the saving glory of the Son of Man. So we return to that little passage, verses 35 to 45. And again, we remind ourselves that after only moments, after learning that Jesus, that the Son of Man will be killed in Jerusalem, we find James and John making this request, grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory, is what they ask for. And Jesus responds to those words with a very powerful phrase. He says, you do not know what you are asking. You do not know what you are asking. Jesus is telling these men, these disciples, that they do not know what they ask, because they do not know what true glory will really mean for the Son of Man. And he goes on to tell them, can they drink from the same cup? Can they be baptized with the same baptism? You see, James and John just casually use this expression, in your glory, thinking that glory simply means power and renown and praise and all of that kind of thing. Again, perhaps they have the Son of Man prophecy in mind. They remember Daniel chapter 7, and there the Son of Man is this king, and in the language of Daniel, he receives a glory and a kingdom, and all peoples and nations and languages serving him. That's what glory means in Daniel for the Son of Man, and that's what James and John are after right now. But what they don't realize is there's another side to that coin. The essence of glory, true glory, is more than just power and praise. See, here Jesus tells them that the glory of the Son of Man looks very different to that. For the Son of Man, glory means an act of the deepest service involving the deepest suffering. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? He asks. He's saying, you want to share in my glory? Well, can you be baptized? Can you be dipped? Can you be plunged into what I am about to be plunged into? Can you drink what I am about to drink, what I am about to swallow? And James and John insist that they can. And actually, Jesus acknowledges that indeed they will share in his suffering, at least to a certain extent. Yes, actually, they will know something of Christ's sufferings. We listened to part of Philippians this morning, didn't we? And where Paul there talks about sharing in Christ's suffering and becoming like him in his death. And James and John would follow Christ into the future sorrow. They would themselves become victims of persecution and finally death for their profession of the name of Jesus. And so in that way then, they would share in the glorious sufferings of Christ. That was true to that extent. And briefly, it's worth just pausing at that point and seeing the significance of that for ourselves, because there is a comfort there in those words for our suffering, isn't there? In every trial of the Christian life, and in particular those uniquely Christian trials, we know that we are being dipped, plunged into nothing worse than what Christ was first plunged into. At the bottom of whatever pit we might be plunged, we find Christ there at the bottom, having been there first. However horrible the cup of suffering is that we're made to drink, we share that cup with Christ. It first left his lips. He drank from it first. There's a true comfort in that fact for us to dwell on. We suffer with Christ. Be comforted by that fact. But you see, even then, we can only share to some extent in his suffering. We cannot go the full way. There is a glory that is unique to Christ because there is a suffering which is unique to Christ. It's the glory of the true suffering servant. And it's a glory that is found in the act, in only the uniquely greatest act of service. See, Jesus says in verse 40, to sit at my right hand and my left is not mine to grant. And I think it's right then at that point that as those who've read the book of Mark before, our minds leap forward to a very similar verse in Mark chapter 15, verse 27. And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. See, that's why James and John don't know what they ask. To share in the suffering of Christ is to share in his passion, his crucifixion. It's to share in the mockery and the spitting and the flogging and the death of Calvary itself. And more than that, verse 44, for even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's the essence of Christ's glory. By shouldering the sins of his people, by carrying them in his body, by climbing the hill and in agony and in grief, bearing all of that sin away, that's where he finds his glory. And of all the dirty work which was committed by all the slaves of this world, you won't find anything dirtier or more humiliating or more dehumanizing than that. Becoming a ransom for his people, giving up his very life for them, dying in their place, taking their sins and being punished in their stead. And in that moment then, the Son of Man enters into a glory, a true glory that commands our highest worship. And so I end then by saying that It's there that we find the greatest of challenges, of corrections to our recurring pride we find within ourselves, our sense of self-sufficiency, our hunger for fake greatness and fake glory. What do we do with that? Well, we look into the greatest and most glorious moment of history, and we see it there at Calvary, in the greatest act of service, where the Son of Man, the King to whom all praise is owed, becoming a slave to all, becoming last, the last of the last, coming not to be served, but to serve for our sakes. And all that is left for us then to do with his people is just simply gaze upon that and adore that and let that sight work in our lives. He does the unrepeatable deed. He takes the never-ending glory. We praise, we worship him. So let that challenge your pride this evening. Let that transform your conception of greatness. We cannot replicate what he has done. Our greatest acts are only the palest reflections of that great act of service. But we can look upon it and adore it. We can adore the Son of Man dying as our ransom, our servant in our place. And we can follow him with blind Bartimaeus. Amen.